Hi, it's Len Testa, the host of the Disney Dish. Today we've got a great show for you. It's the start of our version of Disneyland's 60th birthday party. For one episode every month in 2015, Jim's going to tell you the story of 5 years of Disneyland's history. So over 12 months, we'll get to all 60 years. And on today's show, we're going to go all the way from the beginning of time, which happened around 1920, all the way up to 1955. Before we start the show, a quick announcement. Jim and I recorded a bonus episode for January 2015 on the history of the big Sorcerer Mickey hat at Hollywood Studios, and it's available at disneydish.bandcamp.com. Now that the hat is being removed, or has been removed depending on when you're listening to this, Jim thought it'd be interesting to tell you the story of how the hat got there to begin with. It's a 45-minute tale of marketing gone mad, believe me. Check it out for pay what you want at disneydish.bandcamp.com. And hey, thanks for listening. Welcome back to another edition of the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. This is our second January show, and it's also this year the 60th anniversary of Disneyland. So Jim and I thought it would be great if we could do a set of shows on the history of Disneyland in five-year increments over the course of the year. So for those who haven't yet had their coffee this morning, 5 years times 12 episodes is 60 years. So we should be able to cover the entire history of Disneyland over the course of 2015. Today's episode will cover the prehistory of Disneyland, the period 1939 to 1954. As Jim points out, this is technically episode zero. Jim, this is the origin story of Disneyland, right?
That's right. You know, this is where Ma and Pa Disney find the capsule that landed in their yard and pull out Walt, you know.
when Mother Disney and Father Disney love each other very much.
There we go.
All right. So it starts in 1939. So lots of things happen in 1939. Hitler invades Poland. Other things happen. The world is essentially in turmoil. Why is 1939 the start of our story, Jim?
This is actually the time that Walt began to find himself in financial trouble. Just to back the truck up a little bit, Snow White premiered in December of 1937. And again, Walt always underestimated when it came to finances. I mean, when they initially were planning Snow White, they thought, well, it costs $25,000 to make a short, and we're going to be making a feature that's 10 times the length of a 7-minute long short. So this should cost only $25,000 to make. By the time they were done, Snow White cost $1.5 million.
Whom among us, Jim, is not off by a factor of 60 when we're underestimating things?
But the upside was that the film grossed $8 million, which back in that, it was actually for the longest time until Gone with the Wind came along, it was considered the most profitable film in Hollywood history.
Wow.
But Walt, being Walt, the money began rolling in for Snow White when it went into a wide release in February of 38. Mm-hmm. And by August of 38, Walt is now buying 51 acres of land in Burbank for his brand new state-of-the-art studio. He puts down a $10,000 deposit. Just the land alone costs $10,000. And he eventually sinks $2 million of Snow White money into making this amazing state-of-the-art, animation factory. But as you mentioned, so construction actually begins in 39.
And wow. So he finds the land, puts the deposit down, and construction begins.
Yep. Yep.
All in the same year. That's exactly how Disney operates today, too.
There you go.
So, not really, but Avatar. Go ahead.
And all
in the same year, I mean all in the same decade, right?
There you go.
Pretty much.
There you go. So construction begins in 39, but as you mentioned, the war. You go by the way historians think, the World War II began in September of 39 when the Germans invaded Poland. They'd annexed Austria in March of 38, but this is really sort of what turned the key and got things going. Meanwhile, Walt, they had started animation of Pinocchio in September of 38. And it turns out, as tough as Snow White was been, you know, Pinocchio was so much harder. In fact, there was really? One point they had to stop production and basically throw away 6 months worth of work because the original design of Pinocchio, you know, he was much more a puppet. Frankly, he was kind of obnoxious, and, you know, they had to go back and, you know, rejigger the film. As a direct result, the movie wound up costing $2.3 million. But by the time it opens in theaters of February of 1940, basically the markets in Europe, the film markets in Europe and Asia are beginning to close off to Hollywood product. And that's where Disney typically made 40% of the money off of its, you know, animated features and shorts. So, Pinocchio comes out, and depending on who you talk to at the studio, either lost $1.4 or $1.9 million. You know, it grossed that, which meant it lost $1 million. In fact, in the first annual report for Walt Disney Productions, they actually admit flat out, look, we lost $1 million on that movie.
Wow.
And then coming, you know, now mind you, the studio is still being built during this time. The rest of the staff doesn't move over to Hyperion. They're not all in place to the middle of 1940. And the studio itself, again, costs $2 million. So you've lost $1 million on Pinocchio. You've spent $2 million building your studio. And now here comes Fantasia. You know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which, again, Walt, you know, had bet on Fantasound, you know, the whole notion of, you know, the first time you're going to go see a movie in stereo.
Right.
So rather than putting in wide release, he decides he's going to do what they call a road show. They launch the movie in, you know, one theater in major markets, you know, 13 major markets around the country. Again, Fantasia actually cost a little bit less than Pinocchio. It was $2,228,000. But the roadshow presentations only bring in $1.3 million. And given that it cost, it just setting up the Fantasound equipment and getting it set in each theater cost $85,000, and again, in 1940 money. So
I mean, you do 12 theaters, that's $1 million right there.
Yeah, and so, you know, just, again, this is Walt hemorrhaging money, you know, just, and you know, push yourself in his shoes. It's from, you know, February of 38, where you are hailed as an artistic genius, you know, and you're winning every award on planet, and all this Snow White money is pouring in just, you know, 2 years' time, you are now, you know, you are millions of dollars in debt. You have this brand new studio you're making. You've got, at the same time, this is what's weird is this is when the beginning of the Disney strike is happening.
So Europe is getting closed off.
Yeah. And your own staff is turning against you because, you know, and in fact, what's kind of interesting is it's actually the brand new studio that actually, in a weird way, caused the strike because Walt built all of these, you know, the thing about Hyperion is it was so small and so funky, you know, that you couldn't help but interact with the other staff members. You couldn't have, you know, just, you know, it was a weird collection of buildings. And so Walt was very present, and yeah, everyone felt like if they needed access, if they needed to talk to Walt, they could get at him. We're in, you know, this 51-acre campus with its brand new air-conditioned buildings that, because it was air-conditioned, you know, the you know, just the building was sort of sealed unto itself, and people found them so sort of, you know, rattled away. And I mean, these wonderful Ken Weber designed offices, but they didn't have the access to Walt that they did. And more to the point, a lot of the people that Walt had hired to make Snow White possible weren't the same guys who sort of came up with him from the Steamboat Willie days. And so they were, you know, just discontent, you know, really began to rise during this period. And it was about this time that Walt is looking for an out, looking for a Hail Mary to, you know, to, because again, it's he needs an additional revenue source. He needs something else going on. And this is when he recalls you know, what happened when he first arrived in Hollywood. And, you know, he's come out from Kansas City. He's looking for work. He's got his press card from being a newsreel photographer out in the Midwest. And he uses that to actually, he's got his reel that he's trying to show folks and convince people to hire him. I mean, that's the other thing I think a lot of people don't remember about Walt, is that when he went to Hollywood, it wasn't necessarily to become the king of animation. He just wanted to work in film. And he was initially just trying to get a job anywhere. And he thought, well, you know, maybe he could be a cameraman or something like that. So he goes to all the major studios in town and uses his press card at the gate to get on the lot. And one of the places that he actually wound up spending a lot of time at, I think it was 3 or 4 days in a row, was Universal Studios. He'd take the trolley car out to Universal City, go past the security guard there, and he had one meeting where, you know, somebody watched the reel and said, yeah, kid, this isn't, you know, what we're looking for. But he then kept going back and explored the lot. And and this was, you know, Walt just being fascinated by big time movie making.
And this is in 1939.
This is 1923.
Oh, 23. Okay. So he'd done this. Okay. Got it.
Yeah. Early days when he arrived in Hollywood. And this is Walt, you know, just being on wandering Universal's back lot, where it's like you could go from a Western, you know, street scene and turn a corner and here's a medieval village.
Right. What's the movie where you're walking through the back lot and it's like Roman soldiers, mm-hmm. Having lunch with, you know, Star Trek Klingon people or whatever. It's like that, I imagine. You're walking around and there's, you know, hey, it's Ben-Hur. Oh, it's, you know, it's Dr. Frankenstein. Yeah, you know, stuff like that. Yeah.
That's it exactly, and Walt never forgets anything. So he just tucks this whole experience away in his head. Meanwhile, jumping back to Hyperion Studios, that when they were just making the Mickey Mouse cartoons, so again, never mind, they hadn't even gotten to making Snow White yet, they'd have a surprising number of people turn up at the gate wanting to come in and see how they not only just wanted to see how the movies were made, they actually wanted to meet the characters. And in fact, it got a little strange because they were, you know, they'd have a bunch of people who'd just show up at the gate and they'd want to see Mickey Mouse. Eventually, what Walt decided to do, and I have to credit this story, Jim Corcus found this story, but what they began to do is park two teeny tiny roadsters by the guard shack. And if somebody showed up and asked to meet with Mickey Mouse, or to come to tour the studio, just the guard would very politely say, well, we don't do tours. And you just missed Minnie and Mickey. You know, mm-hmm. you can see that their cars are parked here, but they had to go out and run an errand. And the guard would then pull out, an autograph card that they had and would hand that off to the individual.
Oh, nice.
And it was a nice touch, particularly for the 30s. But again, Walt had identified right from the get-go that people were interested in coming to see what he did, and they wanted to interact with the characters. So as far back as the premiere of Snow White, and in fact at the Carthay Circle Theater for the grand opening, they built a version of the Dwarf's Cottage. It was actually there on the red carpet. In fact, if you watch some of the newsreel footage from the Snow White premiere, you can actually see this thing. And Wilfred Jackson, who was one of the animation supervisors for Snow White, he's the guy who did the silly song sequence in the movie. He's also the guy who was in charge of when the dwarves are around Snow White's casket. Just remembers that he was there with Walt. They were sort of inspecting the red carpet area before the premiere, and they were just sort of marveling at this thing that they'd drawn and painted that was now made real, mm-hmm. on the red carpet. Walt mentioned, you know, I want to someday do stuff like this. I want to, you know, people, you know, wouldn't it be cool if we did a whole thing of these? But just talking in really general terms. Now jump ahead a couple of years, and here's Ben Sharpstein. He's actually accompanying Walt to New York for a test of Fantasound.
What else did he do? I know that name from something.
Well, he was the production supervisor for Fantasia. Again, he eventually, you know, again, a lot of the Disney guys hung on for decades. He did a lot of the television work for early Disney, that sort of thing. So you've seen his name on dozens upon dozens of Disney products at this point.
Okay.
Anyway, it's same thing. Ben, you know, as they're traveling together, Walt mentions that he's kind of noodling on this idea. The closest that he actually came to sort of turning the key on it, there was a dimensional designer that's named Bob Jones. When I say dimensional designer, Bob was the guy who worked in the department that made the maquettes of Pinocchio or the dwarves or that, the stuff that the animators used for reference while they're working on the movies. And he had built a 15 inch tall version of Geppetto's, toy shop.
Okay.
And one day he gets a call from, you know, Walt wants to see in his office and walks in, and there on Walt's desk is the toy shop model. And Walt goes, how much would it cost to make this bigger? And Bob's like, what? You want
twice as big? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Something if it's on a display that people can see from, 10 yards away.
And, and Walt kind of suddenly says, no, if I were to make one of these that people could walk through, how big would that be? And Walt then begins to spin out to Bob what his plan is. And it just, reaching all the way back to Universal, where people, that was the thing that one of the things that impressed Walt about what Carl Lemel was doing with Universal City at that point is, again, this is the silent era. This is before sound kicked in.
Right.
What he was doing was charging people 10 cents to come on the lot where they could sit in grandstands and watch a silent film being made.
Wow. And you didn't worry about noise because it was a silent film back then, so.
There you go. And the other thing that you got to give you some idea of where this was in Hollywood history. One of the other things that occupied the Universal City lot was one of the world's largest hen houses. And,
hen houses.
A hen house. So in the grand tradition of you exit through the gift shop, as you were exiting Universal Studio, having spent the day watching movies being made, they sold you a dozen eggs. So it's like.
That is the strangest tie-in I've ever heard in my entire life.
But it was incredibly lucrative for them.
Eggs.
Eggs, And again, you'll notice they only sold them to you on the way out. You're watching a particularly bad film. You weren't allowed to sort of vote on what was going on.
That's funny.
But that stayed in place at Universal City right up until the launch of the sound era. And, once it became apparent that you couldn't have people looking in and you had to shoot these things in these huge sound stages with sort of all the muffling and dampening so you couldn't hear outside. That business model went away, but anyway, so, Walt remembered that people paid to get on the Universal lot to see the thing made. And what he was proposing doing was, well, what if we take 3 or 4 acres of the 51 acres that we have here and create sort of a little separate attraction? We could do Geppetto's Toy Shop, we could do Snow White's Cottage, and we could even have a ride. We could put people in mine cars and send them into the Seven Dwarfs mine. Which, again, when you consider that here we are in 2015, just on the heels of they finally actually made that ride, for Walt Disney World. Nothing really dies at Disney. And Bob, Bob went off and crunched the numbers and, brought it back to Walt, and they were really very seriously looking at doing this again because they needed to. They were in this weird space where they were losing money left and right. They were ready to seriously begin working on it. When in May of 1941, the infamous Disney strike happened, and it was 5 weeks long, and the company changed in ways that there was a lot of bad feeling. In fact, Walt, the famous South American tour that Walt went on that led to Three Caballeros and Saludos Amigos, that happened because Walt was in the middle of this and really not handling it well, and
yeah.
they had to get him out of the situation. So, you know, he was gone for roughly about 5 or 6 months at that point. And
really, that long? Could you imagine that happening now? Can you imagine Bob Iger saying, "Look, I'm gonna head to South America and not hike the Appalachian Trail"? Who was the governor of South Carolina that said,
"There you go, there you go"? That's right.
I'm hiking the Appalachian Trail sort of way.
Yeah.
Could you imagine Bob Iger saying, "Look, I'm just exhausted and I need to spend six months away from the studio"?
It was a different time.
Much simpler back then, yeah.
Yeah, and more to the point, you know, in fact, what's kind of interesting is that Walt, you know, that it's while he was away and the strike had been resolved, they finished Dumbo, which, oddly enough, you know, because they produced it so quickly and so cheaply, it was made for just under $1 million and eventually made $1.6 million. It was the first film since Snow White that, you know, managed to turn something of a profit. But Walt, because he hadn't really been in the building when Dumbo was being made, this was the film he you know, just never quite warmed to, because it was like reminded him of the strike. And more to the point, it's just, you know, he was always, you know, sort of the genius, you know, who supposedly handcrafted these films, and he was basically out of the building when it was made.
Right.
But anyway, so everything that Bob had kind of drawn up at that point got put on hold. And then, of course, you know, Dumbo goes out into theaters in October 41, December 7th, 1941, Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor. And, you know, that's the next 5 years. You know, it's a really tough time at Disney. The Army Signal Corps moves in virtually the next day, takes over the studio because, you know, they have to sort of ride herd on the, you know, the aircraft factory just down the street. You know, make sure that's protected. Disney, in order to survive during this period, starts doing training films. I mean, they're still making movies when they can. You know, things like Bambi go out the door because that one was so far along in development at this point they couldn't shut it down. But they had an Alice in Wonderland, version of Alice in Wonderland and Peter Pan that was supposed to go in 42, 43 that ended up getting put off for 10 years. I mean, it was a really, really tough time.
Wow.
But at the same time, all Walt can think of is, oh, if I just had another revenue source, if I just had another way. Because, you know, this is the studio's just basically living and dying on how well its animated films do and how well the merchandising sells. And in fact, another interesting little bend on Disney history here is in the middle of the war, when they couldn't get anything completed and, you know, out the door, you know, one of an executive in the building was like, well, why don't we just re-release Snow White?
And have they ever re-released anything to this point?
Never, never. And this, it came out and it saved their butt during the war. You know, in fact, I think that went out in 42 and it did so well that in 44 they put Pinocchio back in theaters. And that created.
This is where it started.
This is where it started. More to the point, this is where Walt learned the value of his film library. And in fact, in the 1950s, when other studios were selling off their entire film libraries to television, Walt was the buck the trend. It's just right. Like, no, I'm not selling this stuff. You know, if anything, you know, I'm going to hang on to it and re-release it every 7 years. And, you know, that's why today, you know, you still have a company that's, you know, hell, we're about to see yet another release of 101 Dalmatians. And now it's what? The Blu-ray Platinum Edition. And I would imagine as soon as they can figure out how to do these things in 3D hologram versions, you know, we'll be doing the double Platinum version. But, you know, again, this is Disney protecting its film library even back then. You know, just valuing its IP above everything, which it's, again, was the smart, you know, that's a smart long-term way to handle this stuff.
Wow.
Anyway, let's jump ahead. It's now post-war. But again, it's post-war after rubber drives and the amount of, you know, steel that went into the war machine, and more to the point, any money that Disney made in overseas markets, a lot of the governments did was said, look, you know, yes, this is your money. We admit it's your money, but you have to spend it here in our country. You know, you can't take it out, which actually in a weird sort of way is what drove Disney into live action. This is why Disney made movies like Treasure Island and Robin Hood. They had to be shot in England because that was where the money had been held. But in a weird sort of way, that kickstarted Disney into doing live action. Meanwhile, the other thing, you know, Walt is just looking at what animated films cost and how long they take to make versus, what it costs to shoot a live action film. And it's right. Like, oh, we're going in that way. But at the same time, the whole 3 or 4 acre idea is still bubbling in his head. So as 46 turns into 47, you know, John Hench actually described coming into work on a Saturday and just looking at, here's Walt on the other side of Riverside Drive. In fact, ironically enough, where the feature animation building now is occupied. And here's Walt out walking in a field, pacing off that land. You know, just, and when John asked him about it, it's like, well, I got this idea for a Mickey Mouse park. But this was not the theme park that we know today. This was Walt trying to sort of recreate a classic Main Street that would then have a Western area, but it was all sort of Americana focused. And, you know, but the weird thing is that with each iteration of this idea, it would go from 4 acres to 7 acres to 11 acres.
It's the typical Walt thing, right?
Yeah. And what really kind of set fire to it is in the summer of 48, Walt and Ward Kimball went to the Chicago Rail Fair during the summer. And on their way back, they looped by Henry Ford's Greenfield Village in Michigan.
Wow. So they did a rail convention.
Yep. And then on the way back in, they swung in for 2 days there. And Walt saw how that was laid out, and that sort of really set fire to the idea. But the other thing to remember about 1940, that Walt's doing this in August of 48. September of 48, Milton Berle debuts on the Texaco Star Theater. And television, whoever you talk to who knows television history, Berle's television show is what supercharged Americans getting into, having television in their homes.
Why? What was television like before that? And then what was the thing that Berle did?
What Berle did is took his vaudeville act and brought it to television. It was loud, it was crass, it was crazy. Up until then you had, Toscanini doing, the symphonies. It was this weird.
Wait, millions of people were learning Latin and Greek on their televisions with that, that sort of approach.
it was illustrated radio up until that point. And what happened when Berle came through the door is that, suddenly people, we had the first water, cooler conversations that people going to work and I saw this on my television. And, people were like, well, I want to see that and, would buy television. And so Walt is sort of eyeballing, Walt's looking at all directions and sees that television is becoming, a big thing and that, that this is probably time to move into that market. So to test the waters, he does a special on Christmas Day, 1950. It's TV special called 1 Hour in Wonderland. And
1 Hour in Wonderland.
And it's basically a promotion. Sponsored by Coca-Cola. I mean, again, in the fine Disney tradition, you get somebody else to pay for it. And it's basically a promotion for Alice in Wonderland, the film that'll be coming out later that year. And it's hugely successful. It does amazing numbers.
Did they have a ratings back then for TV, or was it?
They basically, and again, you got to understand that not every home in America had a television in it, but they had over 50% of viewers tuned in to see what Walt Disney would do for television. And it was so successful, the very next day, Coca-Cola signed them up for a second holiday special.
Parts of this are available on YouTube. Yeah, so live action,
yep.
Black and white.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's, you know, what's kind of interesting is that if you actually watch the thing, you know, this is Walt the Family Man. This is, you know, both Sharon and Diane make appearances in the show. Of course, also Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, but, you know.
Coke sponsored this?
Coke sponsored it.
So there's actually a product tie-in in it where, I guess, Bobby Driscoll was the guy. He actually drinks a Coke in the the film. So Walt not only gets Coke to pay for it, but he does the product placement in the show.
It's pretty shameless, you know. But at the same time, this is a guy who, you know, again, given the fact that Coca-Cola was as excited with the ratings and immediately signed him up, Walt suddenly understood the value that people want me in this space, and they'd be willing to pay me to be in this space.
Ah, okay.
So, and again, this is Walt still trying to get his park built, and having learned the lessons of building his studio, it's like, don't spend your money, you know, right. Spend somebody else's money. So Walt now, you know, pulls together, it's this interesting parallel effort. He starts developing ideas for a weekly television series at the same time that he's pulled together this very tiny unit of people to work on Disneyland Park, at this point it's called Disneylandia.
Like Portlandia. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. And he's still envisioning building it across Riverside. The Riverside Drive along the edge of the Los Angeles River, and they've kind of maxed out what they can do with this piece of land, but he still wants to have it across the street. He still wants to be able to just, you know, walk out the door from his office and go to his park. And so he actually makes a presentation to the Burbank City Fathers and, you know, brings in the plans and you know, I have to tell you, Lynn, I was at the Burbank Historical Society this past year, and some very nice folks there, well worth a visit when you're in town to go check out the exhibits there. And they talk about all aspects, but they actually have the notes from the meeting.
Really?
Where the Burbank City Council turns Walt down.
So he didn't get a chance to come back and revise it. He does one pitch and they're like, this sounds great, but it's not for us.
And it's one singular councilwoman that basically shuts him down. And what she says is that, you know, because the park is sort of designed around a pond because it's going to be next to the Los Angeles River. And she says, you know, I don't want drunken sailors falling into that pond and, you know, somehow besmirching Burbank's good name. It would reflect badly on places,
sure.
You know, on like Lockheed and all the other companies that, you know, NBC that's based there. So she shuts him down. I mean, and you got to understand, this is something Walt has been pacing off for 10 years across the street.
Yeah. Well, number one, he's got to be offended. Number two, he's not going to be denied.
No, that's it exactly. So, you know, what he does is he now reaches out to the Stanford research. In fact, this is where Disney legend Buzz Price gets involved and just hires them to begin a land search. I mean, it's a heartbreaker for Walt because he's always, again, envisioned just walking out the door from his office and going to his park. But it's like, okay, this isn't going to happen. But, you know, go find me some land. And at the same time, he's talking with Roy, and you have to understand that Roy doesn't entirely buy into this idea. I mean, he sort of liked it when it was across the street and it was going to make money for the studio, but now the two things are separated,
yeah.
You know, and it's going to be, you know, it's just, there's a really tenuous connection. And, you know, it was one of those moments where it was a really tough time between Roy and Walt, because it was like, I don't necessarily believe in this idea. I, you know, I've already backed you, and I've always helped you find the money. I've always helped you talk to the banks. But to Roy's way of thinking, it's like, well, you know, we are diversifying. We're going into television. That'll be another revenue source. And okay, we'll kind of humor Walt. And
as long as it's an idea, it's fine. When it comes time to commit, that's where everyone starts bringing up objections. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and so just to give the timetable here, July of 53, Walt hires Stanford Research and at this point, he's tired of trying to cram everything into the 13 acres that were across the street, across Riverside. Walt's now asking for 100 acres, somewhere in Southern California. And
how much acres?
100 acres.
100 acres, okay.
Well, with the notion of 50 acres for the park, 50 acres for parking, and, you know, back a house.
Right.
September of 53, Walt Roy goes out to New York and proceeds to try to meet with, you know, all of the major networks. And the interesting thing is he can't even get in the door at NBC. General Sarnoff, you know, just he keeps getting put off by General Sarnoff's flunkies. CBS is interested, but at the same time, you know, when they find out that it's for, you know, it's tied to this weird park thing that Walt wants to do.
It's an amusement park, right? Nobody has the vision to see what it's going to be, right?
Yeah, well, but that's the thing. And let's remember that the amusement parks at that point are dirty places.
Yeah, they're grimy. They're sort of like...
Yeah, and it's just sort of like,
working class.
All right. Okay, meanwhile, over at ABC, which you got to remember that ABC at this point was just an offshoot of the Dumont Network, a network that's, you know, obviously since faded into the mist. But, you know, this was 13, 13 stations that have been sort of cast off from the Dumont Network. And the joke was that back in the day that ABC stood for the Almost Broadcasting Company. You know, they had so little clearance in the country that, that they were desperate for any high-profile content. So
kind of like the CW or the WB network.
Very much so.
Of the 90s, right? Yeah, we're going to start a network. You have an idea for content? Sure, come on along.
And so here's Walt, looking for a place for his television show. ABC, like, is frantically waving his hands, like, you know.
Over here!
And more to the point, it's like, crazy theme park? Absolutely. How much money do you need? You know, just... You know, and that was the thing, that you had Walt with his crazy idea. You had a television network that needed the legitimacy that a Walt Disney would bring to their operation.
Sure.
And so it was just sort of like two parties out of desperation that got in business together. And in the end, that's where Disneyland actually came from. That once Walt got the seed money from ABC's and the financial guarantees, he could then turn to, Buzz Price and, you know, find me the land. And
so when did ABC commit to this?
ABC committed in September of 53.
Wait, so in September of 53 they committed, but they hadn't. Disney didn't have the land or anything by then.
No, they.
The park opened in July of 55.
There you go. You know, they did.
That's gonna be a wow. Okay.
You know, again, I think that's what's fascinating. In fact, we talked at the top of the show about how long it's taken to build Avatar, and you have to understand that. In the 50s, when, you know, and again, you got to remember, one guy was calling the shots.
Yeah, yeah.
One, you know, and so when Walt said jump, again, he had built this staff of loyal lieutenants. In fact, particularly coming out of
capable,
the
right? They're all capable people at this point, too, right?
So. Yeah, yeah. That's it's just like, how high, sir? And, but here's the financial deal. Let's see. ABC agreed to do a $500,000 investment in the park. They then agreed to open up a $4.5 million line of credit for Disneyland in return for a 35% they were going to get a 35% cut of whatever the park made.
Wow. Could you imagine? Wow. All right.
Now, in addition to that, Walt had to agree to deliver a weekly one-hour television program. And this was not back in the 26-day or the 26-episode season. This was Walt was committing to 40 new episodes per season.
40 per season?
Yep.
Wow. Yeah, okay.
And mind you, they were going to get $5 million a year to pay for this program, but it was a 7-year contract. I mean, it was the biggest Disney pack or the biggest television package deal in history at that point.
Everybody got something though. I mean, Disney got a source of long-term revenue, right? A guaranteed source of revenue. And I mean, let's face it, $5 million, for 40 shows, that's not chump change.
No, it's not. No, it's not. And more. The genius was that Walt could then this film library that he had held back and not sold to television, he could now repurpose for television, and he could also use this $5 million to create new material. It was, in a weird sort of way, it was very much a win-win for everybody. But at the same time, you have to understand that. You know, in the fine tradition of, you know, hey, Snow White is only going to cost us $250,000.
Sure.
Walt thought that between the $500 million in cash that he got and the
$5 million in cash that he got.
Oh, excuse me, the $500,000 in cash that he got and the $4.5 million line of credits. Like, it's current financials for the park say we're going to be able to build it for $5 million. We're covered. But anybody who knows Disneyland history knows that, you know, the park, when it was finally completed, $17 million, you know.
So it's late 53.
Late 53.
He's got $5 million.
Yep. And then, you know, it becomes the land search and finding the right piece of property at the right price. And, you know, that there's he looks at the Willowy Country Club, which, in fact, what was kind of interesting, again, tying back in with the television thing, Walt had assumed that he was going to shoot a lot of television at the park. And it given the Mount Palomar, which is where the television relays for L.A. was, wherever they were building the park had to be within sight lines of that. You know, of this point so that they could broadcast from the park, they could connect to Mount Palomar, and the signal could then be sent to Burbank for broadcast.
Right. Wow. Okay. Right.
So, you know, that actually impacted which sites were being chosen. You know, just sort of like, you know, and again, just I think that's what fascinates me about this, because everyone sort of focuses on, oh, they made the Flying Dumbos, and it's like there was some hard science going into the choices of where Disneyland was going to be built right from the get-go. It wasn't just where do the highways meet, you know, or where is the population going to shoot out to. It was also, you know, we need this, you know, we're in bed with ABC. We're going to have to do a lot of broadcasting.
Yeah, we need the grounds to have these physical attributes.
Yep.
So they must do a land search, right?
They do. That starts in earnest after they have, you know, the money in hand. And
so late 53, early 54?
54.
Yeah, I want to stop, by the way, at the end of 54, because 55 is its own sort of thing. But.
Oh, no, absolutely. And it just, but this is when, you know, in fact, their favorite site, which was just up the street, from where in Buena Park, from where Knott's was going to be was built, Knott's Berry Farm, is a kind of infamous story of Walt always wanted to visit the sites and walk them before making a decision. So
Buena Park is like an 45 minutes or so southeast of
Los Angeles.
Okay, yeah. LA, okay, all right, fair enough. It's closer than where they ended up in Anaheim, right?
It is. And more to the point, they were kind of thrilled that they'd just be down the streets from Knott's, and, you know, in theory that there could be some crossover that could, you know, go to Disneyland during the day and have dinner at Knott's. And, so they actually go to Knott's to celebrate. They have a dinner there, and I guess they talked a little too loudly at dinner. about, oh, this piece of property, and we're really excited about it, and make sure to get the bid in on Monday. And they contact the buyer on Monday and go, I just sold it.
Really? Somebody cut it out from under them. Who did it?
It turns out, it was a speculator who, you know, wanted to bump the price for Disney and hadn't anticipated that Walt would say screw you and go look someplace else. It's now, in fact, there's a giant JCPenney distribution center built on this piece of land. It's literally just off of the 5, but it was a primo beautiful spot. But yeah, it was just somebody who swooped in figuring that they want this really bad and they got
it. And they had the money.
And they had the money. And, wow. You know, anyway, so eventually Buzz finds the Ball Road subdivision, which is this weird collection of homes and orange groves, but it's the right price, you know, within the traffic limits that Walt had set.
It's about 15 minutes farther down.
I-5.
Okay.
You know, and it does have its problems. I mean, it doesn't have a highway ramp yet. And, you know, that's going to, and more to the point, the highway is still marching in this direction.
Right.
But in theory, by the time the park is built, the highway will go out this far.
So Southern California already had plans for the highway.
Yep.
All right. Cause the city probably, moves much slower. And generally for things like highways, you know a couple of years in advance where the highway's going.
Yep.
Okay.
But again, it just when you take the step back, and I know we're 60 years into the success of Disneyland at this point, but you have to understand from that, you know, if you're standing in 1954 and yes, you know, this is the Disney company, but again, this is Disney, who's still not a major studio. I mean, again, it's weird to think of that. But again, Disney was only making 2 and 3 films a year at that point, you know, and re-releasing a new animated feature every 18 months or so.
Yeah, they're still a minor player. They're still second tier.
Yeah, and this is also during the time when Disney's doing things like this is – they're still in the middle of making Sleeping Beauty at this point, which will take a full 6 years to complete.
Wow.
So this is still a tight, scary time for Disney, and nobody knows if, you know, Disney's actually going to be able to make it, you know, in television. So that they actually break ground in – the summer of 54, I mean, they start tearing out the orange groves, and the show doesn't actually debut till late September, early October of 54.
So what was the mood in the company in 1954, right? So they break ground in the middle of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got to be like a 12 months of complete uncertainty. Where is this company going? What are we doing? You know what?
No, that's it exactly. You know, for a lot of people within the company, and in fact, within Walt's own family, you know both Lillian and Roy really weren't certain of this idea. You know that Roy found the money. And, you know, but Roy viewed that that's kind of a famous, trip that Roy made to the site with the bank. Because again, you have to understand that, you know, originally budgeted for $5 million.
Yeah.
By August, they knew, well, maybe we need $7 million. So we're going to have to find some more money. So Roy had to start bringing investors to the site. And in fact, just a quick side note here, I've just finished reading the Bob Hope Entertainer of the Century, the definitive bio that came out. And Hope, evidently for the rest of his life, talked about when Walt Disney went to him and went after, you know, and tried to get Bob to invest in Disneyland.
Okay.
And you have to understand that Bob Hope was the sharpest businessman, you know, in the entertainment
world. He owns a ton of property in Southern California.
And he started buying it in the 40s. I mean, he would just take the money he made from doing the road pictures in his NBC radio show and just turn around and buy huge chunks of land in and around Southern California.
Wow.
And So this was a sharp guy. And so, but Walt went to him and, you know, they evidently drove out to the site, and Hope just looked at where it was and what Walt was trying to do and just couldn't get it and just politely turned him down. But then for the rest of his life, whenever anybody would bring up how rich Bob was and how much land he was, the very first thing he'd bring up, yeah, but I'm the guy who said no to Walt Disney.
I turned down Disneyland.
if I had invested in that, I'd be a rich man today, which tells you, you know, right there that, you know, I mean, again, and Bob was richer than Midas. So, you know, the notion of just this thing that he regretted the rest of his life. But meanwhile, again, so back to Roy, who's now bringing investors to the site to try to get additional money, and you know they're looking at, you know, Main Street starting to rise up with a castle at the end of it, the street, and it's like, and everybody's looking at like that, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen in my entire life, and one of them asks, what happens if it fails? What are you going to do with this?
Yeah, what then, right?
And Roy, without missing a beat, well, no, it's we'll rent it out to other studios. They can make movies here. They can shoot their medieval movies at the castle. They can shoot their, you know, their westerns over on, you know, Frontierland. And, you know, that was the fallback, that if Disneyland crashed and burned, it was going to become a backlot.
Movie sets.
Ha. So, you know, kind of ironic that, you know, you jump ahead to 89 and here's Disney building, you know, backlots in Florida. You know, just, but that was the fallback in 54 that, but yeah, and as they kept going and going and going, you know, there's one story I really kind of want to put out there, and this actually jumps out of the timeline, for 54, but you have to understand that the Disney bought this land and just jumped into it. Didn't do a whole lot of looking into what had been there previously.
Was it an Indian burial ground? Anyway, go ahead. What was it?
Well, no, it actually turned out that during the 1960s, when they were doing some construction in the park, they dug down deep and found a pipeline that hadn't been on any map. That, you know, that didn't turn up on any blueprint.
Like an oil pipeline?
Jet fuel.
They had a jet fuel pipeline! Really?
Yeah. And
wow.
And it was one of these things where they were about to cut into it with an acetylene torch.
We'd still be hearing the echo from that explosion.
But it was just, again, they moved that quickly. Nobody, evidently this is something that had been put in, during the war years, that, you know, just sort of like, this is part of the war effort. We need to get the fuel to the.
Yeah, things were done. We'll document it later, right?
Yeah. And again, it was one of the groundskeepers who knew enough to go to the Anaheim Public Works Department and knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody, who said, oh my God, that's a jet fuel line. You know, and they eventually, I guess, they figured out where it came in off property and were able to off gas it.
Still,
but it still had jet fuel in it.
Wow.
So it could have been real, but again, this is what building Disneyland was like. It was just, you turned the key and things came, you know, they just moved.
At full speed, yeah.
Because they had to make their, 55 opening. And we're going to pick this story up with our next podcast, folks, in January of 55. But just as a teaser, you know, it was actually in January of 55 that Disneyland decided, you know, that Tomorrowland thing, let's actually build it.
6 months and change before the thing opens.
Yeah, they had, again, this was one of the compromises they made in 54. Was like, we don't have the money, we don't have the time, something's got to give. Okay, take Tomorrowland off the table and we'll just put up a sign that says Tomorrowland comes tomorrow. And but again, because one guy was calling the shots.
Yeah.
You know, Walt went out to the site in early December and was looking at this blank space of the canvas, and it's like, we can't not have a Tomorrowland. And, you know, came back and in January announced, we got to figure out what to do. And, you know, and, you know, the sad thing is, because they were rushing Tomorrowland, what was going to be their really big attraction for that land was taken off the table. And that just, this is our final story for this podcast, but you know how when you go to the airport and you're in that space between terminals and they have the moving sidewalk?
Yep.
You're right on that without even thinking about it. That was supposed to be Tomorrowland's big feature, that everywhere else was concrete and brick, but this was it. You had a moving sidewalk in Tomorrowland. This was the future. You know, you came to the hub and you stepped on the sidewalk and it sped you into Tomorrowland. You know, but that was when you decide you're going to build, you know, the future in just 6 months, something's got to give. So
Movie
sidewalk was it.
That's a shame. All right. This has been great. So we'll pick up at the beginning of 1955, the big year for Disneyland, on the next show. Cool. Thanks, Jim.
Yep. Okay.
All right. You've been listening to the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hale. Please go onto iTunes and rate us and let us know what other kinds of shows you'd like to hear next. For Jim, this is Len. We will see you on the next show.